Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week, we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, I'm very happy to say we have Mary Hyman on the show, and we'll be talking about her book, Czechoslovakia, The State That Failed. This book was controversial when it came out in 2009. It's been re-released in 2011 as a paperback. It was suggested by one of the listeners to New Books in History who found it extraordinarily compelling. It shatters a lot of myths, I think we can say. And it, as I say, it elicited something of a response from Czechoslovakia and people who are Czech nationalists. I think that's fair to say. So in that sense, it's a very interesting book for us because we always like historical controversies. So first I want to say, Mary, thanks for being on the show.
You're welcome.
Maybe you could begin our interview by telling us just a little bit about yourself.
Right. Well, I was born in Holland. I was the child of U.S. diplomats. And so I grew up in, we moved countries every 3 years. So I grew up in Southeast Asia, Belgium, Zaire, Washington, and so forth. I think this had something to do with my approach, which might come up later. I ended up doing a PhD in Oxford and then was a research fellow in Cambridge and then a lecturer at York. And then I came to Strathclyde, where I moved away from religious history, which I've been doing up to that point, and well, not completely away, but moved away from British religious history and got interested in Czechoslovak history. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's quite a switch. Most people may know that one of the academia is a little bit like being in prison in the sense that they don't let you change cells very often. I know that in my case, I did a similar sort of thing and sort of switched fields. How is it that you became interested in the Czechs and the Slovaks in this area of the world?
It started as an idea on my way to a job to the job interview at Strathclyde, and my brief was to teach something on continental European history, and my feeling was that I was equally ignorant about all of it, so I could just pick any. And I picked Czechoslovakia deliberately and randomly as a small state that would be maybe a microcosm for looking at themes in European history. And the more I thought about it, the better it got, because I thought you can get, you know, East and West. You've got every now and then it comes on stage. I mean, my only strong feeling was that we always look at European history from the point of view of the great powers, mm-hmm. and what I wanted to do was look at it from the position of a country that didn't have a lot of influence in international affairs, which I think of as being a much more typical European experience. Mm-hmm. So that was what got me interested, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And through teaching, I then got more and more interested, and then realized I needed to learn Czech, and then just got completely gripped and moved to Prague and so on. And mm-hmm. That's how it all started.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I like what you say about Czechoslovakia being a microcosm of, I guess, what I'd call the European experience, because it does have all the European elements. You know, it's multi-ethnic, and
exactly.
It went through these various political phases, which divided people along both ethnic lines and political lines, and sometimes they intersected, and sometimes they didn't, and sometimes they killed each other, and sometimes they were imperialistic, and other times they were really nice to each other, and so it really is sort of Europe in miniature. And so in that way, I think that's a good insight. That had not occurred to me. So tell us why you wrote Czechoslovakia, The State That Failed. I'm particularly interested in the state that failed part, because that is the element that really elicited the most criticism.
Absolutely. And understandably, I think the title came last, as is often the case. And I suppose I wanted to signal a few things. I mean, first of all, I should say that just in terms of the rhythm of the title, it's from a Saki story, The Mouse That Roared, if you remember, mm-hmm. the subtitle. So that's where the rhythm came from. First of all, I wanted to signal to readers that this was not just, as it were, an innocent narrative of the history of the state, although I hope it's that as well, but that there was an argument that ran right through the whole book, that it has a theme. And I think if you put that right in the title, then people know that it's going to be critical of the experiment. I mean, the original working title I had for a long time was The Czechoslovak Experiment, and that's where the word failed came from. So in a sense, an experiment in multinationalism is how I would view it, that did fail. So in 1918, you know, Benesch was promising in 1919, Benesch was promising at Versailles that this would be a sort of Switzerland, a liberal, humane state that would be very tolerant to its ethnic minorities and linguistic minorities. And in that sense, I think we can say that it failed. It also failed in a more obvious sense that it, you know, collapsed 20 years after it was founded and then collapsed again as soon as authoritarianism was taken away. So it wasn't maybe sustainable. I'd be careful. I wouldn't say that the Czech or Slovak nations failed. I would say that they succeeded rather spectacularly well. So it's really the state that failed, not the people. That was the other reason for that title. I wanted it to be clear that it wasn't the Czechs and Slovaks I was critiquing, but a particular state project.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I'm a big fan of nations not writing their own history because they inevitably get it wrong. I know that in my case, I get American history wrong all the time. And I write and have written Russian history for Russians. And, you know, I think that they're probably glad that I've done it because it gives them perspective that they can't have.
Well, it's always flawed as well, isn't it? I mean, I think any Czech or Slovak is perfectly within their rights to turn to me and say, well, look, you don't understand us from the inside. You don't really know. And they'll be right. On the other hand, you do, as you say, have a kind of perspective from being, precisely from not being an insider. There'll be some things you understand, some things you don't. Yeah. It's a good corrective, I think, because there's a great weight of books giving the alternative perspective, which I was trying to critique.
Yes, indeed there are. Let's talk a little bit about that. One of the things that you do in this book, and you do it in a quite thoroughgoing fashion, is puncture what we might think of as myths of Czech and to a lesser extent Slovak nation building and nationhood. There are a lot of things in here. You're very critical of a lot of the sort of general notions about Czechoslovakia. And the one that occurs to me, not knowing a lot about the region, is that the Czechs in particular have been victims, that they either have been pushed around by their neighbors so that they couldn't blossom in whatever way nations blossom, or they've been abandoned by other nations that claimed they were allies. And so they never really had a chance, that they really weren't agents at all here.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose that is one of the central critiques of the book. And I think, again, Czechoslovakia is only an example here of, I mean, I think there are many, many nation states and indeed groups that perceive themselves or frame their whole way of looking at things as through this lens of victimhood. I think it's very dangerous because I think it often, as I think happened in the Czechoslovak case, then leads to a perpetuation of that. The kind of persecution that the victim nation suffers, they then very frequently go on to inflict on someone else. And I think if you actually look at the photograph section in the book, I sort of like to think no one in all, you know, 100 reviews or something, no one commented on the photographs, but I think they tell the story in miniature as well. So you begin with, Hitler walking in and taking over in Prague, and then you see Gypsies Roma being persecuted by Czech authorities, then Germans being expelled. I noticed a couple weeks ago you had excellent book, Orderly and Humane, by John Douglas. I mean, again, that story, and then, you know, Hlinka guards assembling Jews in Slovakia. So each group is at once a victim and a perpetrator. I suppose that's my point. I wouldn't deny that the Czechs were, and that the Slovaks were victims in some ways, but they were also perpetrators. Mm-hmm. And those are very emotive terms, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I suppose my point is that you're not immune. I reject the notion of there being good and bad countries, good and bad people. You know, all nations are capable of these atrocities. All have dark passages in their history. And we know that as Americans, and you know that as well. So I think it's too easy, if you're one of the so-called victim nations, especially in the Second World War, to think, well, there are these bad guys, the Germans, or take any other group, there are these bad guys, the Serbs, the Rwandans, the Iraqis, whoever's on the current bad list, and that then just wipes the slate clean for the other nation.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you see it in a very, you know, in a horrifying way with things like, the Theresienstadt, for example, being used, one camp to persecute Czech nationalists and communists, another camp specifically for Jews, and then after the war, those same camps being used specifically for German speakers, not people from Germany, but local German speakers. So, you know, horror perpetuates horror, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about Czechoslovakia itself. One of the things that always struck me about Czechoslovakia is its unlikelihood. It was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. A lot of, I don't want to call them nations, but large ethnic groups that had some degree of consciousness in the 19th century were part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. They all didn't get states, and they certainly didn't get states where, you know, there were several nationalities that were intentionally cobbled together to form a kind of Switzerland and that's a funny image to me. Switzerland in Eastern Europe. How is it the case that Czechoslovakia came to be created? Why was there a Czechoslovakia at all?
Well, I think that's a combination of the political skill and diplomatic skill of the few the people who were originally Masaryk and Beneš originally campaigning for Bohemia. But I think the main reason, I mean, the conventional answer, this isn't something new I've come up with, is that it suited the Allies' aims, war aims. I mean, and I think Beneš and Masaryk were very skillful in persuading the Allies that, first of all, in equating Austria with Germany in propaganda, and also through the gallant Czech legion in Russia being the only people on the spot at the right time. So, I mean, there was a combination of luck and skillful exploitation of that luck and skillful use of propaganda. And I think Andrea Orzov has written an excellent book, The Battle for the Castle, that set some of that out too. That came out at the same time as mine. Mm-hmm. So we were obviously working along similar lines independently.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, one thing people might not, I don't know if people know this or not, but Czechoslovakia as such did not only have Czechs and Slovaks in it, it had other people in major ethnic groups. Maybe you could just talk about the biggest of them, beginning with the Czechs.
Well, first the Czechs. The second largest group was the German speakers. Only the third largest group was the Slovak speakers. There's another complication that Czech and Slovak were sometimes considered the same language and sometimes not. They're close enough to be 95% plus and mutually intelligible. So, you know, in a different context, they might have been called dialects. So it's not, however, this is, as I'm sure you know, politically it's like Serb and Croat, you know, they're absolutely considered separate languages, and, mm-hmm. and a great deal of scholarship's gone to prove that they have different etymologies and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But for the purposes of collective imaginings of oneself as a nation, the Slovaks, it wasn't clear. I mean, one of the things that the Czechs kind of say in retrospect is that, you know, we, in effect, helped the Slovaks gain their sense of nationhood, to demagyarize, as they call it. A lot of Slovaks didn't think of themselves as Slovaks exclusively. They thought of themselves as Hungarians, mm-hmm. who also spoke another dialect. That's another complication. The Czechs and Germans had a much longer history of mutual antagonism, and so we're kind of sharper and clearer in being on different sides since the 19th century. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I've wandered off your question here.
Well, no, but the southeastern part of what becomes Czechoslovakia is particularly complicated because we have people that we don't even think about them as existing anymore. Ruthenians.
Yes.
Like nobody even knows about them.
Yeah, I mean the Ruthens, if we want to call
Russians,
them that. I mean, they speak a language which is, on the political right, got defined as Ukrainian, under the Soviet Union, got defined as Russian. Again, it's the Slavonic languages. You know, it's a long. There aren't sharp divisions. You know, as one dialect, if you like, merges into the other and gradually becomes a separate language.
Yeah.
So it's a complicated issue. These are much more politically fluid categories than Westerners always understand.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then there, of course, one sharp linguistic boundary is the Hungarians.
Yes, that is a sharp linguistic boundary. Again, that's comparable to the Czechs and Germans, if you mm-hmm. like. It's another sharp one.
Right.
They're the two non-Slavonic languages.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you have Jews, and Jews, again, are a slippery category in this thinking, because Jews were often, and more that's intriguing me, that they were really considered a sort of subspecies of Germans, because of being associated with German names and, you know, for historical reasons, and also speaking Yiddish in some cases and so on, and also often voting, as it were, in the census. In the old census, you could only choose one nationality, and often Jews would opt for German. And even the ones who opted for Czech were later, often those same people were later expelled as Germans,
even though
they'd opted for Czechs in the census. So there's a lot of fluidity and a lot of contingency.
Mm-hmm.
And you do see genuine real-life stories of these things where people in the same family might be expelled, one might be accepted, one might you know, be welcomed into the Communist Party, another sort of, and, you know, there are these terrible ironies. It's nothing to do with blood or race.
Mm-hmm.
It's to do with language and political identification.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how did these people come to consciousness, or that is, their political elites, how did they come to think of themselves as nations in the 19th century? Or did they? Or was, you know, did the Czechs take themselves back to the 15th century? I don't know.
Ooh, that's a big question. I don't know how far I can generalize about that. I mean, I use this kind of blanket term, romantic nationalism, mm-hmm. to try and evoke the same sort of nationalism you got in the late 18th century. That was sort of like striking an attitude, and it's a bit like, you know, I live in Scotland, it's a bit like wearing a kilt in Parliament,
mm-hmm.
or so quite a lot of these fathers of the nation didn't even speak the language of the group they were supposed to represent. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, if you take even a case like Masaryk, who's the founding father of Czechoslovakia, the first president, you know, what are his credentials? His mother was German speaking, his father was Slovak speaking, so you sort of think, well, how did you get to be founding father of the Czech nation?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is. So I think, at least in the 19th century, you could choose. You know, you could decide. You could have a conversion to the Slav side as a German. And most of the famous founding fathers, or you know, Paratsky, all these other people, they did. They chose. You know, they chose to be on that side.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think also the emperor, the Austrian Empire, had a lot more to do with it than is generally or widely recognized. You know, there was a lot of subsidies. There was a lot of encouragement of the Austrian project was about multinationalism.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of encouragement of the smaller nations, if only to break the domination of the Germans, who were becoming too strong a bloc.
Mm-hmm.
That's the.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see how that could work. So let's go back to 1918 and this unlikely birth of a nation. So. Again, this will sound simplistic, but, you know, being American, I always think about Wilson. Wilson goes over and says, here's Wilsonianism. Every nation gets its own state.
Not quite what he said, of course.
Well, yeah, not quite what he said. Not quite what he said. But if we generalize in that way, how do you get Czechoslovakia with all these Hungarians and Jews and a bunch of Germans? And, you know, that's a very confusing thing. It seems like it's not consistent with Wilsonian principles at all.
Well, first of all, we could have a whole other discussion about Wilsonian principles, which, you know, of course, his diplomats immediately, you know, wrote in their diaries, oh my God, how could he have uttered such a stupid thing?
Yeah.
You know, he's created a terrible problem here. But there's an inconsistency in Czechoslovakia, because there was a pretty good argument, or I'd say a very good argument, for saying that the territory, the geographical territory of Bohemia, should have independence. It had a history of independence. It was considered a discrete political unit, if I can put it that way. So there's a certain sense in that. The trouble is, because it had a third, sort of one German speaker to every two Czech speakers, you could have it be a coherent entity as a territory, but not as a nation state, not
mm-hmm.
as a Czech state. And therefore, that was the reason, that was the rationale for bringing in the Slovaks, because if you took the Slovak speakers of Upper Hungary, which is where they were, there was no place called Slovakia until this point, then that gave Czechs plus Slovaks a majority in the state. So then you could sort of call it a nation state. But if you did that, you had to also bring along, for strategic reasons, a fair chunk along the border with Hungary. So southern Slovakia, a large contingent of Hungarian speakers, and then, as you were saying before, in the eastern side of Slovakia, and into Ruthenia, then you have this mix of a large proportion of Jews, Rusyn, Ruthenian speakers, and, you know, even more of a mix, and a lot of poverty too, which was a problem for the state. That region was very poor and rural.
Mm-hmm.
And again, a lot of the Jews there were ex-serfs. They weren't people in the towns necessarily.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is one of these cases where it's hard for me to put myself in the seat of the people who decided this, because it seems like there's only two results from this. One, there's a large group of pretty powerful people who are really dissatisfied and have a resentment. That is the Germans and the Hungarians. They don't like it. And whether they'll put up with it, I don't know. I mean, I can't think they didn't think this. And then there's the Czechs, and they're basically in an untenable situation because they have to deal with these populations that are pretty antagonistic.
I suppose, I mean, yeah, it's a bit of a dangerous game to play, the sort of what-if game, but in history. But I suppose it could have been handled better is one thing I'm maybe saying. I mean, the Bohemian Germans didn't have a lot in common with German Germans, if I can put it that way, and that, I think, came out quite starkly and during the war, and I think Chad Bryant's written quite interestingly about what happened to these Sudeten Germans, some of whom were very enthusiastic for the Reich and all that. When they actually got it, it wasn't quite what they expected, and they weren't treated like equals by the other Germans. They were treated like second-class Germans, they said, and so on. So they were kind of yokels, if you like, mm-hmm. in the view of the Germans. You know, could it have been handled differently? I mean, had one thought might be a federation like that, where you would have, because these regions were relatively discrete within the state, so could you not have had perhaps a Hungarian district, a German district? Would that have been less stable or more stable? I mean, we don't know, do we?
Why didn't they do that, though? I mean, were the Czechs pushing against this, or?
Yes. Yes, I mean, they were very, very nervous right from the start. The first thing that they were really frightened of was a Habsburg restoration. That was the big fear. And all the, you know, and there was some kind of humorous complaints by the head of the intelligence services in the 30s saying, you know, I can't get any intelligence on Germany at all because all I'm getting is, you know, what the Habsburg princess had for breakfast. And, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. So they at first I think there was just some misguided, I suppose it's natural always to fear what's happened in the past rather than to be able to anticipate what's around the corner. Mm-hmm. And I think some of it was that they just didn't see the future dangers. They saw the past danger. They saw the danger of being forcibly returned to Austria-Hungary. They didn't see initially the danger of Germany, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, well, this is something Tim Snyder's actually written about, and it was news to me that there was a kind of entire Habsburg revival movement in the 20s and 30s.
Yes.
I just thought they were gone and sort of disappeared. They all moved to Paris and New York.
I mean, it looks that way with the benefit of hindsight.
Yeah.
But again, think of 1848, and I mean, that must have been somewhere in the folk memory that you can have a revolution and then it can all go right back mm-hmm. within a short period of time.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about the two principal figures here. The much of the book is bound up with them and what they wanted and they did. And the first one is Masaryk, and then the second one is Benesch, his protege, I don't know. Talk a little bit about Masaryk and his role in all this.
I suppose Masaryk's only in the beginning, that's for the first part of the book, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
The country's being established, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's an enigmatic figure, isn't he? I think he carried a great deal of weight and authority, and I think deservedly so. He's very impressive if you hear him interviewed or you read his writings. He comes across with a certain kind of gravitas and authority. However, there's other stuff which I haven't quite got to the bottom of yet, and I still haven't for this book, but he was certainly working for the British intelligence in some capacity. This is a whole other thing that I think will eventually get uncovered, and was offering his services to quite a few. So there's more to this than meets the eye. And then if you look at all the English language biographies and French language biographies singing his praises, they're all by people who were also mixed up in intelligence or who were working for him. So there's, you know, there certainly was a promotion of Masaryk also by the Allies as a way of preventing Germany from being too dominant in the post-war settlement. So I guess that's I think Masaryk was very skillful and helpful at persuading the Allies that he would be a good tool to use in this regard, mm-hmm. That their interests were in common. And he wrote all these pamphlets, and he was a very energetic propagandist, and, you know, placing articles in the newspaper and keeping the momentum up and knowing when to use something. Benesch was indeed his protege, and he had a whole circle that had of admirers that had been around him since the turn of the century, after his conversion to the Slav cause, and they carried on working for him, and then he used movements that were already in existence. So the only serious movement for independence apart from his own abroad was one, the Slovak League of America, and he managed to negotiate with them and come to deals. I mean, later there were all kinds of complaints that he hadn't kept his side of the bargain and so forth. But mm-hmm. I think he was a skillful diplomat, operator, propagandist, all of the above.
Yeah, he really was. I mean, I know that I can tell you that, in all honesty, as somebody that studies, well, I sort of study Eastern Europe, I don't think I've ever read a bad word about him. I really don't, because he just
until
seems,
now.
You know,
yeah.
Until now, because, you know, he seems like the George Washington or something. I've never read a bad word about George Washington either. I'm sure there are bad things, but, you know, they just seems, you know, he wrote books and then he had followers in the West and, you know, he's this kind of huge, larger than life figure. There was kind of cult of personality developed around him.
Yes. And my guess is that he actually probably was modeling himself quite deliberately on George Washington, as it happens. His wife was American. And he was very, very conscious of these kind of figures and he worked systematically at promoting this. And also he did have his own private intelligence service as well, in addition to the state one. I mean, he also, again, if you look at Orzov, for example, she went into the archives of that in a lot of detail.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have, that book wasn't at my disposal when I wrote this, but I mean, a lot of what I suspected or hinted at, she's brought out more fully in her book. So, it isn't just me, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
It's there in the archives.
Mm-hmm. So let's move on a little bit. The Masaryk and his fellows set up a Democratic Republic. And, you know, again, what I read was it just worked wonderfully until these Germans
yeah.
showed up. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there were several problems with it. I mean, I think that the essential problem is... I think the way, if you try to get yourself into the heads of the people who set up the state, I think they thought in terms of national groups. So they thought in terms of, you could argue that the state was democratic in the sense that that individuals had democratic rights. So far, so good. That's true. The problem was that even if the way it worked in practice was that there were five Czech political parties who came to a kind of gentleman's agreement behind the scenes that they would always support each other's policies. So they had a kind of coalition government in practice, even when it wasn't there in name. And as it happened, those were the five dominant Czech political parties. It was known as the Pětka, the five. So you can sort of see the frustration in 1935 where it came to a head, where if you look just at election results, the most popular party in terms of the ballot was the Sudeten German party, and then followed by the Slovak People's Party. So the two most extreme nationalist right-wing parties were the dominant voice. Had it really been properly democratic, those would have been the parties that got in. So it's a kind of, it depends what you call democratic, you know. It was democratic in the sense that it didn't go over to authoritarianism. On the other hand, it wasn't representing the will of the people. So I think that the democratic, I'm sort of I'm not sure I'm being very clear here, but the democratic reputation it has, it served the Czechs to have the so-called democratic parties in power because those were also the Czech national parties.
Mm-hmm.
And the German and the Hungarian and the Slovak parties, as it happened at that time, were not democratic-minded or were more right-wing,
mm-hmm.
more extreme right-wing. Anti-Semitic and all that kind of thing. So it looks good in a way, but it's not. It certainly wasn't representing the will of the people. So where people point to Czechoslovak exceptionalism and say, "Oh, look, you know, they were surrounded by a sea of totalitarian states, and Czechoslovakia alone withstood it." Well, if you look at it from a different angle, the Czechs were dominating over the other nations in their state, just the way the Germans were over the Jews or the D.C. So it was a means. I think had it been more democratic, it would have been authoritarian, which is kind of a horrible thing to
mm-hmm.
say. But
mm-hmm.
I think that's objectively true. That mm-hmm. was true, and it's not really that surprising. I mean, it would be sort of surprising if it was the one state in the whole region that was completely different in its outlook. That would be surprising.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is something. I was going to say this is something that I talk about with my students when I teach this era. I don't teach it in great detail, but and we're coming to the era of fascism, is how popular fascism was in general.
Ooh.
It was, you know, a lot of the right-thinking people were loved fascism. They thought it was a great thing. And thought it was, you know, the future was fascism. And so let's move on into the 30s. The Germans, who were Bohemians, and maybe before that they were subjects of Austria, decide they're Germans all of a sudden. Am I wrong about
yeah.
that? Yeah, they do, I think. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, decide. I mean, first of all, you know, in a way, nobody. I mean, this was one serious fault of the Habsburg system that was then inherited or perpetuated by the Czechoslovak system. That in the census, you could only belong to one nationality, which was clearly absurd. This was, you know, a region where families were mixed, people were mixed, and you know, lots of people spoke two languages, three languages. So you had to kind of choose, and then people would choose for all kinds of reasons. They would choose, you know, mostly for, you know, if you had to pick. If you had to generalize very broadly, on the whole, people were going to choose the nation that was advantageous to them at that particular moment, mm-hmm. and they might then switch back in the next census. So it could have a lot to do with, you know, whether you wanted your child to go into the good school down the road, and if that was Czech or German, or if you wanted, you know, whatever kind of advantage you thought you could get. And in the Czechoslovak state, if you look at the figures, Germans didn't really get anywhere being Germans. So in the Foreign Office and so on, you know, there are almost no German representation. You know, they were treated, at least by the secret police and by the state authorities, with suspicion. Just by being German, you were immediately an object of suspicion and monitored and so on. And you can sort of see how that would may have been intended to promote homogenization or... You know, and Benesch confidently predicted that in the future, you know, this was a gradual, natural process, that the Germans were slowly going to be eliminated through osmosis with the Czechs, and this would just happen naturally. It was a sociological process that no one could stop. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that kind of talk was obviously very frightening to Germans who were, again, as you say, in the 30s, where everyone was so acutely conscious of this as being an important part of their identity. And then they were subject then to all this propaganda from the Third Reich as well. So I think it pushed Germans in both directions. You know, some did try to merge or found that they were unable to, found they were repelled by the system they were trying to join. And then others, may, you know, were lured or attracted by the kind of promise of the future. And of course, Germany was a great success story for a while, wasn't it? It was, you know, mm-hmm. unemployment was going down. You know, it was all looking very rosy.
Nation of the future.
Yeah. So I think it's a complicated story, and I think the Jews were increasingly caught in the middle.
Mm-hmm. So,
as well, yeah.
I was going to say, let's move on to the Munich crisis, or what we call the Munich crisis. I don't know what the Czechs call it. What do the Czechs call it?
They call it the Diktat.
Yeah, right.
Usually, I mean, uh-huh. or the conference, or the yeah,
right.
Or the
so
agreement, any of the above, but Diktat you hear quite often.
Right. So the way popularly. we treat that in the West is we call it appeasement. You know that, mm-hmm. that we basically give up. Did you have a take on it, or what do the Czechs feel about it, or?
I mean, the Czechs, you know, again, of course, there are lots of sophisticated Czech historians who have a more informed view, but the kind of popular view is that it was this monstrous diktat. It was imposed against the will of the Czech people. They weren't consulted. They weren't involved. I mean, it's, you know, it's the first of the two great traumas, I think the second being the invasion after 68.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the first, and this, you know, won them, as it were, the laurels of victimhood ever after, really. But again, it's more complicated. I mean, let me first say, you know, I do think, you know, one can go too far being a revisionist. I mean, I do think it was, you know, obviously humiliating and awful, and particularly what happened next was awful. But there was the actual agreement itself. You know, Benesch, there wasn't. I don't think by that point there really was another option that was viable, as far as I can see, and Benesch could have been represented. I mean, I forget where I saw that, but the Benesch could have been represented at the conference. I mean, he wouldn't obviously have had any weight or any voice whatsoever. And he basically begged, you know, please impose it on us so that it won't look like we mm-hmm. are a party to this awful capitulation. Because, I mean, it clearly was a complete failure of everything he promised and stood for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was, he brought about exactly the calamity that the whole state was set up to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tragedy in more than one way.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's kind of general rapaciousness. The Hungarians and the Poles get into the same business. And you know, that is, they take chunks of Czechoslovakia, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I mean, of course, if you were looking at it from their point of view, they would say, well, you took chunks of it 200 years ago.
Right.
You know, and actually the real victims there are victims, there's plenty of victimhood to go around, but the Hungarians came out terribly out of the First World War, didn't they? And much more dramatically, and I often think, you know, when students in class say, oh, well, you know, you can forgive the Germans all this because look what had happened to them, you think, well, look at what happened to Hungary,
mm-hmm.
you know. although it wasn't pretty what happened next, it wasn't as bad. So but I think for Hungarians, I mean, they lost, what was it, 2/3 of their population and state, and the bit that was called Slovakia was a really core part of their medieval Hungary going back into the, you know, to the dawn of time. So, as I say, I don't think there's one country in the region that wasn't both a victim and a perpetrator.
So let's move forward a little bit, and then we have the complete calamity that Czechoslovakia disappears. I think it's called the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia or something, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. Although you've done what everybody does, which is skip over the middle bit.
Okay. Which, yeah. All right. Go ahead.
I don't mean it to tick you off.
It's
just interesting how everyone does that. Between Munich and the actual takeover of the protectorate, or the creation of the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, I wrote one chapter just on that. It's only 6 month period, which is why everyone kind of skips over it. But that was actually, for me, where the key of the thesis or the revisionist thesis of my book came from, was by taking that period in slow motion and looking at it more carefully. And what I saw there was that a lot of things which I had assumed, like everyone else, were imposed by Germany or by Hungary afterwards actually already had begun under Czech and Slovak authority.
Mm-hmm. So go ahead and tell us what those things were.
Well, that's where you begin to get anti-Semitic legislation, for example. And it's also where really the Slovak National Party turns from being what I think had been a kind of moves over that borderline, to my mind, from being a right-wing party to being a real fascist party that has this notion of corporate, a kind of Catholic corporatism, that there's, you know, the nation is almost like a medieval body, which cannot include, and it's a Christian one, so it excludes Jews on religious grounds. So again, anti-Semitic legislation coming in and anti-Semitic persecution coming in Slovakia at that point that had nothing to do with Germany and wasn't even predicated on the same kinds of arguments. So it wasn't based on race, it was based on confession. So if you were born of two Jewish parents, let's say, but converted to Catholicism, you would not be persecuted, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you were, if you were Jewish or non-Catholic, you would. So it was different from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important because it shows it was local and homegrown fascism, much more like what was going on, I think, in Romania.
Mm-hmm.
And they had, you know, paramilitary groups. And they also, a lot of the structures of authoritarian regime that later reemerged under communism were developed in Slovakia precisely at that time, 38 to 39,
mm-hmm.
and then through the First Slovak Republic, the Wartime Republic, which was a fascist, the Czechs call it clerico-fascist, so, you know, because it had this Catholic dimension, and the dictator was a Catholic priest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I should add, this wasn't approved of by the Vatican. So there was, that was where I began to realize that these things that are presented as if they were misfortunes that always came from outside, you know, almost like bad weather, that these actually had native homegrown roots.
This is mostly in Slovakia, what we would now call Slovakia. This is mostly the Slovaks we're talking about right now, right?
The Czechs too. Right. Again, they abolished the political parties, had only two. Mm-hmm. There was one party of the left, one party of the right. Began bringing in, and they were about to move. They were about to move to a one-party state. They were on the verge when the Germans intervened. And again, the reason for the German intervention is also not widely known. I mean, what happened was that Slovakia declared independence first, and then that gave Germany the excuse to say, "Oh, we're coming in here, you know, to clear up this mess."
Mm-hmm.
So, and also everything that Slovakia did, Ruthenia immediately copied. So Slovakia declared independence. Ruthenia then declared independence. Poor old Ruthenia was independent for exactly 24 hours and then got taken over by Hungary. And Slovakia carried on independent till 1945.
Sobering. So then let's go on to the period of, Nazi rule. What happens in that period?
Again, very complicated because first of all, not sure we should really say the Nazis, the Germans, because the first protector wasn't a Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
He was von Neurath, and he was a military man, a sort of traditional German military man. initially, the treatment was nothing like as bad as everyone had expected. And that, I think, then set the tone for the rest of the war, that it was easy. It would easily have, it wasn't a place like Poland where the regime was so awful that you were sort of driven to an extreme. It was more like Vichy. And you had the same problem of collaboration, I think. Mm-hmm. So the Czech president continued, the Czech parliament continued to meet. These things weren't abolished. And side by side, but then in theory, these were supposed to be only for Czechs, and the German speakers were all honorary citizens of the Reich suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
And they had their own completely separate administration under the Protector. So they had in Berlin, they had a German administration, somehow they were being ruled from Berlin. It depended on what race you were in the German view, mm-hmm. who you were beholden to, and that created all kinds of complications. So you had different sets of laws for different people. And to some extent, most of these laws, of course, discriminated against Czechs, but even in the discrimination, some sometimes gave them advantage. For example, if you were a German, you, of course, as a patriotic German, were going to want to volunteer and fight in the war, whereas if you were a Czech, you weren't allowed to. So, there were all these... So there were Czechs who sat at home during the war prospering. It may have been humiliating, it may have been unpleasant, it might not have been what they wanted, they may have resented it, and they clearly did. But on the other hand, if you were a German, having the honor of going to war and being killed might not have been what you had in mind either.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as clear-cut as it at first appears. And as I was saying before, the Sudeten Germans found that they were often discriminated against in favor of Czechs because the... again, this isn't my work. Chad Bryant found that in his book that some Germans were being, would kind of say, well, the Czechs are much more like Germans than, in terms of being so-called Germans and being hardworking and so on, whereas these Sudetendeutsche are these yokels and they're lazy and, we'd rather promote the Czechs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, I happen to remember that the Slovaks mustered actual units that fought with the Nazis, or with the Germans, let's say that.
Very proudly, yep.
Yeah, what did the Czechs do?
In terms of, they didn't have units.
No, they didn't,
The Germans, is that what you mean?
Yeah, right? No, how did they relate to the Germans during the war? That's a dangerous question, I know.
Sorry?
It's a dangerous question, I know.
Well, no, just hard to answer because there were so many different responses.
Yeah.
I mean, there were people who collaborated very actively and energetically. There were people who... resisted, heroically, bravely. There were people who were, I guess most people were probably somewhere in between,
mm-hmm.
I think they were very much, I think German rule was very much resented and hated. I mean, I don't think that's myth-making. I think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for a lot of Germans, for a lot of Czechs, it hadn't really been that long, it had only been 20 years. I think for a lot of people, they might have felt, well, okay, that didn't work, back to reality, except that the German regime, the protectorate, was much worse than the Austro-Hungarian.
Yeah.
And it was a much harsher regime, and it got really appalling under the Reichsprotektor, the second Reichsprotektor. I mean, I think at first it really was a bit like a return to Austria-Hungary in some respects, whereas under Heydrich... It was a different proposition, but he was a kind of Nazi zealot. He was a very different kettle of fish. And he was, of course, the Czech parachutist who was based in London and went back, Czech and Slovak, successfully assassinated him, very much against the wishes of people living in the territory who then had to face all the reprisals.
Yeah.
But it was a spectacular symbol for the Allies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So let's move toward the end of the war, and I'm... I have in mind what I learned from Ray Douglas's book, Orderly and Humane, and one of the facts that was really amazing to me is that even at the sort of beginning in 40-41, this displacement or movement of Germans was already being planned once the war was over. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I too, like you, this was one of the things I found really shocking, and I found that in the archives, and then Ray Douglas's book came out shortly afterwards, and I was lucky enough to read it in manuscript sort of just after my book had come out, so I thought, okay, You know, it's even, it was, I realized from his book that it was even worse and on an even bigger scale than I had realized. But again, for me, I guess two turning points. One was finding out about this Second Protectorate, Second Republic from 38 to 39. That changed how I saw the story. And then the second thing, I think, was this immediate post-war time of horror. And I think for me, what was really horrifying was realizing that it wasn't about the war and it wasn't about Nazism as such, that a lot of this was really just like, okay, this is a good opportunity. I mean, Benesch was very explicit privately in his private correspondence. Oh, this is a fantastic opportunity. It's been given to us on a plate. We can now get rid of all the Germans and it'll look like it's just anti-Nazi. Mm-hmm. You know, that was that really was the thinking, I think. And again, it ties in with what he was saying all along. I mean, he had hoped that the Germans would slowly be absorbed by the sort of dominant Czech nation. The idea was that Czechoslovakia would eventually, slowly, gradually become a nation state.
Mm-hmm.
And the war then gave an opportunity for speeding this up, this process up.
Mm-hmm.
So the Jews had already been pretty much got rid of. That wasn't the intention of, I should say, of the Czech authorities at all. That wasn't
sure.
One of their plans. They did intend to get rid of the Roma, however, and were pretty successful at that. So, you know, the Jews were out of the equation for all intents and purposes. The Roma were out of the equation for all intents and purposes, apart from Slovakia, where they'd done better, where they'd survived better. And, you know, here's an opportunity for changing borders, potentially, or if you can't change borders, then keep the same borders and move the population. So to get rid of Germans. And the other thing people never pay attention to is, again, the Hungarians. The Hungarians were also got rid of.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on what basis? You can sort of see the arguments, even if they're spurious, for getting rid of the Germans after, you know, the horrors of the Nazis and so on. And again, one has to keep emphasizing, these weren't Germans from Germany. These were local people who had never lived in Germany,
mm-hmm.
never necessarily had anything to do with Germany, who just happened to speak German. Okay? Now, some of them may, in fact, have been energetic, and some were energetic supporters of the Nazis and so on, but by no means all were like that. So, you know, this notion of collective guilt because you speak German, but then also collective guilt because you speak Hungarian.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I should say, as Davis points out, they were mostly children, women, and old people because all the men had been taken off. Yeah.
No, that's who was left. And so, I mean, that shows you that it's really about getting rid of a whole group. I mean, you can see the argument for them, and I think the idea was that the only stable Europe would be a Europe that had nation states that were discrete and you know, self-contained, and that if you couldn't do it, this was a golden opportunity, you know, for sorting that out once and for all. And I think the Allies, you know, again, as Douglas's book brings out as well, the Allies went along with that.
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
And
Totally did, and that was also surprising to me.
Again, all through this, whatever critiques I'm making of the Czechs and the Czechoslovak administration, I mean, this could be leveled at any country in Europe. This is not. I'm not picking on them. This is just one example where you can see, again, Europe in microcosm.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we're running out of time, and I have a lot of ground to cover, so let's do it quickly. So one of the images that you get from, so the Soviets come in, they occupy it, and socialism takes hold, kind of authoritarian socialism takes hold in the new Czechoslovakia. And again, this is just from my primitive reading and sort of listening to the news over the years. We have this notion of Czechoslovakia resistor nation. And that, you know, we think about 68 and all this other stuff. And can you talk to us a little bit about Czechoslovakia under communism?
Okay. Well, I mean, I think the first important thing to remember is that in 48, although it's called a coup, it wasn't a coup. There was a cabinet reshuffle. Okay, that was no arms were involved.
Mm-hmm.
There was no actual force. And I think Czechoslovakia, it was not only the last country to fall behind the Iron Curtain, but it was also the only one to do so. You can't quite call it voluntarily in a system that already wasn't really quite democratic, but as voluntarily as anywhere else. I mean, the Communist Party was the majority party elected in freely in the last free elections in 46. So, and the country was already on the road to socialist. I mean, it was going to be a socialist state. It was just a question of how quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So in 48, you know, all that happened was that the ministers, some of the non-communist ministers resigned, hoping to spark general outrage about the communists slowly taking power, and instead it backfired, and with Benesch's agreement, they then formed a government. and then took over. And then they very rapidly did turn it into a kind of really a very Stalinist sort of model of communism initially. It got, I'd say, from 49 to 43, it was really, really as bad as anything you could see anywhere in the behind the Iron Curtain throughout the post-war period. It was the worst show trials, the most fear, I think, really a police state. I think probably a lot like the GDR. That's probably they were probably the two worst. And again, probably no coincidence that they were on the border with the West. 68, again, I present a much more complicated story than the heroic story. I mean, first of all, I traced Dubček's rise to power. I just was curious, you know, what he was doing before he got known for the Prague Spring, and found out that the story was very interesting. I mean, he'd grown up in the Soviet Union. He'd been there under Khrushchev during the reforms. He came back, and he became leader of the Slovak Communist Party, the provincial party. And there he he loosened censorship as an experiment. And my argument, I can't prove it, but it certainly fits to my mind with what happened next, that he loosened it in order to discredit his opponent. So whereas in the 50s, communists got rid of each other, got rid of rivals by putting them on show trials or setting them up with scandals, with the help of the secret police, he tried a new way, which was more effective in the end, and left him, you know, without blood on his hands, which was to just let the press leak things to the press, mm-hmm. and let them be discredited that way. And this was very successful in Slovakia. It made him very popular. He also allowed Slovak nationalism to be tolerated and to grow a bit, and I think that supported him. He then came back. He then was kind of parachuted in, as it were, to the main Communist Party in Prague and tried the same techniques. And I think my verdict is that he was out of his depth, really, and what worked well in the provincial Communist Party couldn't work in the National Party in the same way that he'd hoped it would. And it got out of control. There was just too much demand for, you know, people. It kind of opened up rifts within the party and the kind of power struggles that meant that he was gradually losing control of the party. And I think the Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact, although I don't think what they did was, you know, defensible, I think it's understandable. I think their verdict that he had lost control of his party was either true or was about to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they stepped in to defend the Communist Party from weakness, really.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, Dubček has this reputation, again, as, you know, he's Masaryk and Benesch and these things, as not a Stalinist. I guess I'd put it that way.
Yeah, he certainly wasn't a Stalinist. That is absolutely
not
true.
A Stalinist,
that wasn't his temperament.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean he was, he certainly wasn't a convinced liberal, which is how he's often portrayed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think there were some people in his Politburo, in his presidium, who were convinced reformers and you know, radical reformers. He was not one of them.
Yeah. So let's move on then, I guess, to the end of the whole show. How and why did Czechoslovakia fall apart in your interpretation?
You can answer that on several levels. I mean, I guess the stock sort of Czech and Slovak answer you hear is that nobody wanted it to fall apart. Nobody wanted the country to split in 92. But on the other hand, the two nations couldn't agree on anything. Whatever was up for discussion, they could never get agreement. And so in the end, they fell apart almost by default. I mean, there was never a referendum about, and some people feel bitter about that. So the split was decided by the representatives of the two sides. And, you know, Meciar was not a particularly democratic person. So, that's still, I guess, resented. I suppose, on the other hand, the kind of inevitable conclusion of all the chapters in Czechoslovak history that I was looking at suggest that probably they couldn't live together when things got bad. You know, it was okay in good times,
mm-hmm.
but that strain would always be there. And they are very different. I mean, I think they're very friendly nations, but they're very, to one another, but they're very different.
Mm-hmm.
They have very different, the Czech side is much more secular-minded, much more socialist. The you know, to this day, and the Slovak side is much more traditional Catholic and, you know, different sort of, I mean, I think, if you like, Hungary has left a long mark on Slovakia and Germany on on the Czech side, on the Bohemian side, so they're different cultures, really.
So what's it like today? Again, I haven't, you know, really spent any time there to speak of. What's it like today to be a Czech or a Slovak? Do people pine for the old days of, I don't know, where do you start? The Habsburg Empire or, you know, the 1920s? Or what do they think about as their golden age?
Well, I mean, the Czechs still talk about Masaryk and the First Republic in the 20s, the 30s as a golden age. The Slovaks, some Slovaks still hold up the First Slovak Republic. You know, for all its faults, they say it was independent. It was the first thing. I think what's most striking to me is how much Czech and Slovak public discourse still turns around the kind of national concerns and the kinds of generalizations about other nations that I've critiqued in this book. So, certainly, I think notoriously, it's very hard to have a conversation with anyone about gypsies, for example, because the racism is so strong and so near universal. And I mean, I know President Havel, the former President Havel, talked about this a lot and also talked about attitudes to Germans and so on. So I think in Hungarian-Slovak relations, in German, Czech, and in discussions of the Roma, you still hear a lot of these prejudices really completely unreformed. And I think if I had a moral purpose, I mean, I'm extremely fond of the Czech Republic and Slovakia, and I've, you know, I'm married into a Czech family now, and I love the place. And I suppose part of what I was trying to do in this book was to suggest that this isn't a good way to continue thinking about other nations. And that it does lead to these kind of horrors. And even in a country that's proud of its, and rightly proud of certain traditions of humanity and democracy and so on, which are also part of the Czech story, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned what other people think, because I did have a chance to read some reviews of your book, and I think you're a brave person. Because some of them, I don't know if I could have withstood all that. Some of them were vitriolic. I think I'd put it that way. Hey, can you talk a little bit about what it's been like to receive some of this criticism and maybe how you've dealt with it? Because, I mean, a lot of it has been very, you know, it doesn't exactly go at, well, some of it does go ad hominem. I'll be honest with you. Some of it
absolutely
does.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I don't think that's appropriate, obviously. But I just want to, as an author, I wonder what it's been like.
Yeah, I mean, it was very, first of all, just the amount of attention it generated was, I mean, I did think it would create some kind of a splash, but I had really underestimated how big that impact would be. So I had something like 100 reviews and hundreds of emails and letters and hate mail, fan mail. I had a, believe it or not, a Austrian princess came over to take me out to lunch. All kinds of, I got a letter from someone from British intelligence. I mean, extraordinary things happened. So all that was I believe I was condemned in a speech by a Czech consul for a crime against humanity or something.
Yeah.
Anyway,
you can put that on your CV, I think.
Well, I think there were several waves. What I tried to tell, I did reply to every email and letter I got, and one of the things I tried to say to people who wrote just hate mail was that I was sorry that the book had hurt their feelings, which is clearly what that's about, and that my intention wasn't set out to give a bad impression of Czechoslovakia, but to try to show that, you know, even in a country as relatively humane, decent, liberal as Czechoslovakia, the kinds of horrors that we usually associate with fascism, communism, authoritarian states, and so on, were possible. So that this is a universal, modern human problem. It's not just a matter, as I've said before, of certain nations being bad nations and other ones being victim nations. We're all capable of. We all have these dark passages in our history, and we're all capable of perpetuating these kinds of atrocities. So that's my first point. I think for most Czechs, part of the problem was, I think they assumed wrongly in my case, because of my surname, because of the way it's spelled, that I must be of German origin.
Yeah.
As it happens, that spelling was completely made up, and it's Jewish, you know, which is, as a taxi driver once said to me, you know, he said, oh, what's your name? And he said, are you German? I said, no. There was this long silence. He said, are you Jewish? And I said, well, you know, the family origins are Jewish. And he said, there was this long silence. I said, do you have any idea which is worse? And he's like, hard to tell, you know? They're both pretty bad. So,
Yeah. Well, you know, just knowing a little bit about your background, it's pretty hard to say what you are. I mean, I mean that in the best possible sense, because you're a person, both in terms of your descent and also your experience. I mean, you're from everywhere and you've been everywhere. I mean,
to be honest, I do think my perspective and also my sense of, I'm afraid, moralizing zeal in this book, it does come from my experience, because I have been a minority most of my life, and I've been the other, the national other, and I know what that feels like. And I also know from the inside something of the dynamics of great powers and small nations. So these are themes that are close to my heart. And, you know, as a little child moving around, you know, like every other child, you know, you're taught you're supposed to hate the Chinese or whoever it was. I was like, okay, fine, I'll hate them. And then we'd move countries, and then this time we're supposed to hate the Germans. Okay, fine. And then this time we're supposed to hate the French. And then this time we're... And after a while, I realized that it just didn't work, because it stopped making sense.
Yeah.
So I think it made me particularly sensitive to generalizations about people on the basis of nationality, religion, race, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it gave me, and I suppose that's very American anyway, to have this kind of crusading zeal about it. That's in me too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things I found very interesting, Americans, you probably know, they love Czechoslovakia and they love the Czech Republic today. I mean, Americans just go there in droves.
Sort of, until they live there for a while.
Yeah, well, it's funny, because the person that suggested this book had gone there, you know, looking for utopia, and lived there a while, and came back and said, you know what, this place is not nirvana. I think it does hold a special place in the American consciousness among European nations, as the Czechs, especially the Czechs, I don't know about the Slovaks, being kind of innocent. And I think, as you point out, and this is something we talk about a lot on the show, you know, these things like, rampant nationalism and fascism and communism, in hindsight, some of them have been they turn out to have been very harmful. And the thing about it is, it's always hard to predict which ones will appear harmful. Because you don't know if we were alive 100 years ago, if we wouldn't have been strident nationalists, or 75 years ago, if we wouldn't have been fascists, or 50 years ago, if we wouldn't have been communists. I mean, I'm old enough to remember communists. I mean, really smart people who thought it was the way forward. I mean, these people were not fanatics. They were smart people.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
So, you're not casting aspersions on the Czechs or the Slovaks. You're just saying they're kind of like everybody else.
Exactly. and as it happened, I know that I don't think I could write about Nazis, because I know that I'm not, I couldn't really be balanced, I don't think, in my assessments. Whereas with the Czechs, they may think this is a pretty backhanded compliment, but because I love Czechoslovakia, or the Czechoslovak republics now, because I feel at ease in Czech society and love it there, I feel I kind of have license to critique it the same way I would criticize the States or anywhere else I feel at home, you know?
Yeah.
So it's only once you feel you belong, or up to a point belong to a place, that you feel you have the right to be critical about
I would I would like you to come to the United States and live here for a while, and then write a political history of the United States, because I think we need it. Because what we got going on now, nobody understands. We've lost perspective, I think. So we need you to come over and help us out. So anyway, Mary, I want to thank you very much for being on the show. We've been talking with Mary Hyman about her book, Czechoslovakia, The State That Failed. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. Again, Mary, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I hope that everybody has a great week.